This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to The Economist, offering authoritative insight and opinion on international news, politics, business, finance, science, and technology. Stay tuned for the go-to magazine for great minds around the globe, right here on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is a reading of The Economist, and I'm your reader, Mary Kiefer, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I will be reading from the June 28, 2025 copyright year of The Economist Newspaper Limited, and now I'll begin with the cover story, How to Win the Peace. Donald Trump gambled. But has he won? He has bombed Iran's nuclear program and immediately imposed a ceasefire on Israel and the Islamic Republic, and without a single American casualty. That is vindication over those who, like this newspaper, feared that Iran would lash out. But the risks were only half the calculus. The other factor was when America would be able to use a strike to stop Iran from building a nuclear weapon. The best way to accomplish that would be now for Mr. Trump to reach a full nuclear agreement with the regime. He can bolster it by pressing the Middle East to solve its problems through trade and investment rather than preparing for wars. These are daunting tasks. But if Mr. Trump even partially accomplished them, he would have secured a prize that has eluded his predecessors. His efforts should begin with an assessment of how much his 14 bunker-busting bombs and 30 or so cruise missiles damaged three facilities in Iran. Characteristically, Mr. Trump claimed to have obliterated the Iranian program. Within days, he was contradicted by a leaked assessment from the Defense Intelligence Agency that warned that Iran had been set back by only a few months. But it was preliminary and low confidence. It, in turn, has been contradicted. The furious row now unfolding might not obscure the central truth. Bombing alone was unlikely to verifiably destroy all Iran's facilities and was never going to eliminate Iran's nuclear know-how. Its purpose was to set back the program, or better, persuade Iran that a nuclear weapon was not worth pursuing at all. Regardless of how much damage has been done, Mr. Trump now needs to accept that this insight must be formalized in a nuclear agreement. The president has more than American bombers to help him. His raid was the culmination of a stunning 20-month Israeli campaign that has broken Iran's two-decade strategy to extend its malign influence over the Middle East. Its nuclear program cost tens of billions of dollars, but far from deterring a foreign attack, it provoked one. Iran spent tens of billions more on a network of militias and clients across the Middle East. One purpose was also to deter Israel from attacking Iran. But after being struck by Hamas on October 7, 2023, Israel took Iran's proxy network apart. Having been humiliated, Iran's regime is at a fork in the road. It could chase a bomb, but if this was discovered, the country would be isolated and face another round of attacks. It could also infuriate ordinary Iranians who have endured hardship and repression even as their taxes have been frittered away by a regime that proved unable to defend them. The alternative is for the military officers who have increasingly elbowed aside the mullahs to conclude that waging a revolutionary struggle against Israel and America is a fight the Republic cannot win, and that their own prosperity and survival would be better served by peaceful engagement. Mr. Trump can influence the regime's choices by offering a nuclear deal in everyone's interests. America should demand that Iran give up its stocks of highly enriched uranium and submit to intrusive international inspections. Iran should be able to enrich uranium to reactor grade, but under tough terms that require it to be part of a consortium of countries working offshore. In exchange, the negotiations would be about lifting European and American sanctions as well as threats. Do not imagine this will be easy. The urgent question is, what became of Iran's 400 kg of highly enriched uranium, which was targeted in the American strike? Nobody trusts Iran to tell the truth, but it will be very hard for the regime to prove what it doesn't have, or for international inspectors to account for every kilogram after such extensive bombing. For its part, Iran trusts nobody, including the inspectors. The negotiations risk getting bogged down in recriminations. That is why Mr. Trump should also change Iran's incentives to go nuclear by trying to set a new direction for the Middle East. Israel is now the region's dominant military power. After October 7th, many Israelis have concluded that survival in a dangerous neighborhood demands the relentless application of violence. Its armed forces strike targets in Lebanon and Syria at the first sign of an emerging threat. Far-right factions in its government want to use this dominance to annex Palestinian territory in Gaza and the West Bank. After its victory over Iran, Israel should turn the page instead, as it did with Egypt after the war in 1973, and as it began to in 2020, when it normalized ties with several Arabian states in the Abraham Accords. The aim should now be a similar deal with Saudi Arabia, but that will require a ceasefire in Gaza's Israeli acknowledgement of the principle of two states and a move away from a permanent state of war. To bring about nuclear deal and normalization will be very hard, especially for a president with a short attention span and a tendency to improvise. And yet Mr. Trump has strengths. He dominates the Republican Party, so Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, will struggle to outrank him in Congress. Having helped Israel, Mr. Trump has earned the authority to bang heads together as he did on the White House lawn on June 24th when he furiously demanded that Israel observe his ceasefire. Mr. Trump loses interest, as is all too if Mr. Trump loses interest, as is all too possible, the alternative will be bleak. If Iran's nuclear program looms once more, Israel will bomb Iran again. But a second or third campaign would be technically and diplomatically harder than the first. Iran would have learned lessons, and the world would lose patience at the repeated use of war as a temporary fix. America, obliged to support Israel even if it did not fight alongside it, would find that the Middle East sucked in military resources and political focus that it wanted to direct toward Asia. Eventually, bombing could come to seem futile, driving a wedge between America and Israel. Mr. Trump has gambled. If he is to win, much hard work lies ahead. Vaccine madness. America's health secretary is jeopardizing public health. When it comes to vaccine, President Donald Trump's instincts have sometimes been sound. In May 2020, he launched Operation Warp Speed, which came up with inoculations for COVID-19 based on a new mRNA technology at an unprecedented pace and scale. By one estimate, COVID vaccines averted 18.5 million hospitalizations and 3.2 deaths in America in 2 years, and Mr. Trump wisely got himself jabbed. So why is he now letting his health secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., dismantle the country's vaccine-making ecosystem? Mr. Kennedy is what is known politely as a vaccine skeptic and impolitely as a crank. He is undermining trust in, sensible scrutiny of, and incentives to invest in one of modern medicine's greatest wonders. Time and again, he casts spurious doubts on the safety of vaccines. His department has hired a conspiracy theorist to investigate a long-debunked link between vaccines and autism. He warns against the human papilloma virus, HPV vaccine, which is estimated to have reduced American cervical cancer deaths by 62% in the past decade. As a lawyer, he was involved in a lawsuit against the vaccine maker Merck. He promised that any profits from it would go to his son, but that hardly erased the conflict of interest. He has scrapped the recommendation that expectant mothers should be vaccinated against COVID, as 120 other countries advise. He called the measles jab a personal choice and urged giving children vitamin A. Several have been hospitalized for liver damage from vitamin A overdoses, and measles is resurgent in America, along with whooping cough, another vaccine-preventable disease. At least 8 people have died this year. Mr. Kennedy's efforts to warp scrutiny of vaccines are equally troubling. This month, he fired all 17 members of a committee that determines what vaccines are recommended and thus funded. A new 8-member committee has less expertise and more doubts. It includes 2 former paid witnesses in legal cases against vaccine makers. Mr. Kennedy insists this will ensure Americans receive safer vaccines. More probably, they will receive fewer. As if all this were not bad enough, he is cutting funding. One step is to cancel federal contracts to develop vaccines for bird flu and HIV. Another is to refuse to support global efforts to roll out vaccines in poor countries, which benefits Americans by limiting the spread of infectious diseases. Alarmingly, he also has some power over a federal scheme that shields vaccine makers from litigation. Vaccines are unusual because they are given not to the sick, but to billions of healthy people. By the laws of chance, many who receive them consequently fall ill. To prevent vexatious lawsuits from making vaccine production a money loser, many countries have schemes that weigh the evidence and directly compensate those who suffer such things as allergic reactions, nerve damage, or clots. No one claims that vaccines never cause harm, only that the benefits far outweigh the costs. Mr. Kennedy has criticized vaccine liability shields, which make life harder for litigators. If he uses his power to hobble America's scheme, drug firms could pull vaccines from the market, drastically raise prices, or cut back on research. So his boss faces a choice. Will he let his most eccentric benchmen continue to undermine public health? Or will he show the same good sense he demonstrated when he launched Operation Warp Speed? If Mr. Trump is wise, he will brave the ire of his vaccine-phobic supporters and rein in or sack his health secretary. Big League City. Oklahoma City has been reborn. The loudest arena in the National Basketball Association is in Oklahoma City. At the final game of the league championship on June 22nd, the crowd willed the local squad onto victory at 110 decibels. It's an on-court sports accomplishment, says the city's mayor, David Holt, of its first big league title. But it is also a prism through which to see the progress of our city. 30 years after a white nationalist bomb tore through the local federal building, killing 168 people, Oklahoma City's residents are determined to be known for something other than the terrorist attack. A big league championship is the latest step toward that goal. The city's rebrand, however, is much broader than that. More than $3 billion of taxpayer-funded capital investments since the bombing have brought business, culture, and people back to a once desolate city center. The basketball arena was one of the city's first big projects. Later ones include the kind of projects that might attract high earners, including a streetcar system and a civil rights center. As a result, Oklahoma City now looks like a place where professionals want to sip matcha lattes. The city's low costs and low taxes are big draws, too. Its fortunes used to rise and fall with the price of oil, but aerospace and bioscience businesses have added fresh blood and ballast to the economy. A 50% increase in population since 1995 has also made the city more diverse. The percentage of white residents declined from 75% in 1990 to 54% in 2020. It is also increasingly purple. Republicans used to win the surrounding county by double digits. Donald Trump squeaked in with just over 49% of the vote in 2020 and 2024. If Oklahoma City is unexpectedly liberal and welcoming, that is perhaps in part a legacy of the bombing itself. The price of political extremism is never far from residents' minds. There is a memorial museum where the bomb's crater once scarred the city. It teaches the Oklahoma Standard, a set of values which emphasizes generosity towards one's neighbors. It is, the city hopes, a practice that visitors might remember it by in the future. This week's obituary is for Violeta Chamorro, the first female president of Nicaragua, who died on June 14th at the age of 95. Her living room was full of dark wood furniture like a shrine, and that was what Violeta Chamorro intended. The walls were covered with photographs of her husband, Pedro Joaquin, alone with the family at work. A glass cabinet held one of his shirts. It was caked with blood. On display, too, and bloodied, too, were his glasses, the coins from his trouser pocket, and the floor mat from his car. The car itself, restored from the attack, was propped on blocks outside. It was a blood-red sob. They had been married for 27 years before, on January 10th, 1978, he was shot dead. The order was presumably given by Tachito Somoza, the third in the line of dictators who had ruled Nicaragua since the 1930s. As editor of La Prensa, the Chamorro family highly respected newspaper, Pedro had ceaselessly attacked them. He was nothing if not persistent. He had kept chasing her, even when she insisted she didn't like him or his city ways, she being the daughter of a rancher. She refused to go to the beach with him, but reluctantly one day went with him to Mass. He carved a heart into the pew, and it was entirely because of him that she became the first female president of Nicaragua. She never had the least desire to go into politics until he died. In Macho, Nicaragua, a girl like her, educated at posh Catholic boarding schools, including in Texas and Virginia, did not need to bother her head about men's business. Her future, when she married, was to support her man and bring up children. But that was all Violeta wanted. Being married to Pedro also meant enduring long spells when he was jailed, tortured, or exiled for his scathing editorials. But she learned to cope with that. When in the 1970s people began to discuss the Sandinista rebels who were gathering to oust the Somoza regime, she assumed they were just another band of grumpy young socialists. Pedro was unimpressed for a grimmer reason. They were two Marxists. La Prensa was not much kinder to them than it was to the Somocitas. This meant that when, a year after his death, the Sandinistas swept into power, they were not her friends. At the start, she joined the junta, a demure middle-class woman flanked by four scruffy men, but after 9 months, she said she was ill and left. It was not quite a lie, because their Cuban-flavored militarism made her sick. She would not be called comrade. They also suggested at one point that she should help with the coffee harvest. What? Her pick coffee? There were workers to do that kind of thing. Besides having taken over La Prensa, now she would not have her views dictated, as Pedro never would. During this decade, with Sandinistas locked in war with right-wing contra rebels, the paper was closed 5 times. Each time it sprang up defiant. Both it and she became symbols of resistance, though without any Somocista connection. So that when an eventual peace agreement mandated free elections in 1990 and 4 candidates lined up to oppose Daniel Ortega, the Sandinista president, she was suddenly the best bet, the martyr widow. She won 55% of the vote. So there she was, an elegant silver-haired housewife in charge of a devastated country. Not only a decade of war, but decades of despotism before it had reduced its people to despair. Some 40% of the workforce was unemployed, and inflation was more than 13,000%. Since she did not pretend to know what to do, she handed day-to-day governing to her son-in-law, Antonio Lacayo, who patiently and astutely turned policy toward free markets. That improved things to some degree. She could assist by charming presidents in Washington to restore American aid, but her principal task as president of Nicaragua was to be Pedro, to bring about his dream of democracy, reconciliation, and peace. She did so with a mother's common sense. To her, rebels of any stripe were just boys. She would make them sit down and talk to Doña Violeta about what they really wanted out of life. Before a meeting with Salvadorian guerrillas, she kindly sewed on a button for one of them. The Contras, whose cause had been backed illegally by the United States, she also called Miss Muchachos, and persuaded them to disarm in exchange for houses and land. Automatic rifles from both sides were buried under concrete. Conscription was scrapped, which reduced the army by more than half. Controversially, because she thought it would avert future violence, she left Sandinistas in charge of the army and police. She also freed from jail the men who had mown Pedro down. Many people, mostly men, thought she was not up to the job. She strongly objected. She was Violeta Barrios de Chamorro. Her family had already produced 2 presidents of Nicaragua. Nobody governed her, and she made the first decision and the last. She had campaigned in white and wore it later for a reason, to show she was politically pure, and was dedicating herself to bringing Nicaragua, her family, lovingly together. That task began at home. 2 of her 4 children, Pedro Jr. and Cristiana, strongly supported the Contras. The other 2, Carlos and Claudia, were active Sandinistas, Carlos even running the official Sandinista newspaper, Barricada. She made sure they came to dinner with her most Sundays, leaving their politics outside, but she did not try to change their minds. At the end of her term, she handed power graciously to Arnoldo Alemán, only the 2nd time in Nicaragua history that 1 elected president had succeeded another. In 2007, however, Mr. Ortega and his gang of thugs returned to power. Pedro Jr. and Cristiana were expelled, and in 2023, she too, now very frail, left for Costa Rica. She was still the most popular public figure in Nicaragua, but she had not achieved anything on her own, besides God, who fulminated her, and Antonio Lacayo, her mainstay. There was Pedro. Persistent as ever, he had advised her all through. Her photos of him and his bloody relics gave her strength. After she stepped down, she placed among them her framed presidential sash. Hang on their words. The best novels published in the 2nd quarter of 2025. At this time of year, many in the Northern Hemisphere will be gearing up to wind down on a summer holiday. A reprieve from work provides an opportunity to relax and read. If you are looking for a novel to pack in your suitcase, consider one of these titles. Those stuck at home or in a cold country may also escape reality in their pages. Among Friends by Hal Ebbett. This elegant debut novel features 2 wealthy families who come together to celebrate a birthday at a country house in upstate New York. Misdemeanors and cutting comments cause tensions. A harsh betrayal puts long-standing friendships to the test. A tale of charmed lives and strained loyalties. That's Among Friends by Hal Ebert. The Director by Daniel Kelman, translated by Ross Benjamin. This novel recreates the life of G.W. Pabst, an Austrian film director, in the 1930s and 40s. When Austria becomes part of the Third Reich, Pabst is forced to make films for the Nazis. His decision to collaborate with the regime has a profound impact on his family and his reputation. Blending fact and fiction, this tale is a study of art and complicity. The Director by Daniel Kelman, translated by Ross Benjamin. Next is Fox by Joyce Carol Oates. When Francis Fox, a charismatic boarding school teacher, goes missing, Horace Zwender is brought in to investigate. As the detective builds a profile of the mysterious Fox, he starts to uncover a catalog of shocking crimes. This sprawling yet immense novel is rich in suspense, diabolical secrets, and psychological insight. Fox by Joyce Carol Oates. Fulfillment by Lee Cole. Emmett is an unloader at a distribution center who aspires to become a screenwriter. His half-brother Joel has achieved success as an author and academic, but his marriage is on the rocks. His wife Alice yearns for a different kind of life. When the siblings are reunited at home in Paducah, Kentucky, tensions mount and a love triangle takes shape. a riveting tale about hope and desire. That's Fulfillment by Lee Cole. Great Black Hope by Rob Franklin. Smith, a young black man, is arrested for the possession of cocaine in the weeds after the tragic death of his roommate. His wealthy parents in Atlanta offer him guidance, but he opts to follow his own path, one that may lead to destruction or redemption. Revolving around a well-drawn protagonist, this is a sharply focused debut novel. It's Great Black Hope by Rob Franklin. Let Me Go Mad My Own Way by Elaine Feeney. Claire O'Connor returns to the west of Ireland from London to care for her dying father, but when she comes into contact with an old flame, Tom Morton, her attempt at a new start in life is hampered by memories of past pain. Claire's story opens out into a multi-generational drama about love, reinvention, and the lasting impact of trauma. That's Let Me Go Mad in My Own Way by Elaine Feeney. Next is Ripeness by Sarah Moss. In the summer of 1967, Edith travels to Italy to help her sister Lydia through the last stages of her unwanted pregnancy. In the present day, an older and wiser Edith is troubled by her friend Maeba, who is keen to welcome her unknown American half-brother to their Irish village, but opposed to the presence of African refugees. This novel weaves together two narratives to examine family ties and national identity. That was Ripeness by Sarah Moss. Last is The Wildlings by Lisa Harding. With echoes of Donna Tartt's The Secret History, this propulsive novel follows Jessica and her friends as they fall under the spell of Mark, a fellow student at a university in Dublin. When Jessica acts in Mark's play, she becomes even more enthralled to him. Soon he is directing her, not just on stage, but off it too. His manipulative games lead her into dangerous territory. This is dark academia at its most gripping. The Wildlings by Lisa Harding. Right On, a magisterial biography of William F. Buckley, the man who put the charm into conservatism. This is a review of a book entitled Buckley, The Life and the Revolution That Changed America by Sam Tannenhaus, published by Random House, 1,040 pages. It costs $40. Ready to feel lazy and unaccomplished, William F. Buckley wrote his first bestseller when he was 25. Over the next 57 years, he would write more than 50 books, including 20 novels. When he was 29, he founded the National Review, a magazine. When he was 40, he created Firing Line, a public affairs TV show. He would go on to host 1,505 episodes. Buckley wrote and edited thousands of articles, made thousands of public speeches, and quixotically ran for mayor of New York. He won 13% of the vote. The most influential American journalist of the 20th century, Buckley poses a challenge to a biographer. How to say something new about someone so widely known who said so much? Sam Tannenhaus, an American historian who spent more than a quarter of a century working on this superb biography, meets that challenge through judicious curation of the public record and workmanlike digging into private one. The result is a clear, humane portrait of Buckley and his influence on the American right. He was born in 1925, the sixth of 11 children in a devoutly Catholic family. His father was an oil man from Texas, his mother a socialite from New Orleans. Buckley had a peripatetic childhood. He was brought up between America, Britain, France, and Mexico. This left him with a languid mid-Atlantic drawl that he used to great effect on radio and television. He stepped onto the public stage in the wake of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency, which had left American conservatives reeling and rudderless. America's emergence as a world power after the Second War frustrated the isolationists. Roosevelt's New Deal did the same to its doctrinaire laissez-faireists. America's two political parties were not as ideologically polarized as they are today, and the election of Dwight Eisenhower in 1952 signaled the triumph of the Republicans' liberal wing. The so-called conservative Buckley wrote while an undergraduate at Yale, uncomfortably disdainful of controversy, seldom has the energy to fight his battles. But he relishes the cut and thrust of public debate, on the page and in person. Buckley's mission was to grid the right for battle, to stand athwart history, yelling stop, as he wrote in his first issue of the National Review. Unlike its coevals, the National Review was designed for persuasion, not choir preaching, and also through Buckley's sparkling prose to delight. It was skeptical of state power and gleefully ready to fight conscious liberalism. It was also staunchly anti-communist. Though that led to some unsavory alliances, Buckley ardently supported Joseph McCarthy, a senator prone to making unsubstantiated accusations of communist sympathy. It put Buckley on the right side of the greatest ideological battle of his lifetime. Waging that fight in print was one thing. Finding a politician who was both uncompromising and, unlike the charmless McCarthy, appealing to voters was another. The first viable presidential candidate Buckley championed was Barry Goldwater, a plain-spoken senator from Arizona who embodied the nascent libertarianism wing of the Republican Party. He lost all but six states to Lyndon Johnson in the presidential election of 1964, but shifted his party rightward. The seed that Goldwater's candidacy planted came to fruition 16 years later when Ronald Reagan won the presidency. Much of the right, including Buckley, never really warmed to Richard Nixon, who had made peace with communist China. Reagan was a regular reader of the National Review. In the first editorial after Reagan's victory, the National Review boasted, in jest but not incorrectly, that it had assumed a new importance in American life. Anyone looking for humor, the editorial joked, would have to look elsewhere. We have a nation to run. Reagan offered Buckley the job of ambassador to the United Nations, but he declined. It would have been less lucrative and fun than writing and editing. Fun does not imply frivolity. It was instead central to Buckley's success. He was warm, generous, and had a gift for friendship. He had passions outside politics, travel, music, and above all, sailing, about which he wrote four books that contained some of his finest writing. He became, as a profile on 60 Minutes, put as 60 Minutes put it, a kind of national character, and the conservative man for all seasons. His television work broadened his audience. He was engaged, skeptical, and courteous, even to his political opponents. Gore Vidal, a writer as waspish and eloquent as Buckley, was a notable exception. Their debates inspired a play of 2020 called Best of Enemies. Buckley's views evolved over time, particularly on race. As a young man, he defended Southern segregationists, stating that the white community is the advanced race. But by the late 1960s, he argued for criminal justice reform and said, "We need a black president." And when a right-wing third party made Lester Maddox, a former governor of Georgia, its presidential candidate in 1976, Buckley called him a semi-literate segregationist and said the party had wandered into the fever swamps of the berserk right. Near the end of his life, he defended federal intervention to enforce civil rights legislation. Buckley broke with his party over the Iraq War and died in 2008, though he would have been impressed by Donald Trump's ability to command attention and would have been no fan of today's identity-obsessed, soft-on-socialism Democrats. He was no Trumpist avant la lettre. He would have been appalled at Mr. Trump's vulgarity, ignorance, and use of the state power to target personal and political enemies. He would have relished the fight for American conservatism. The country's politics is worse and drearier without him. Do longevity drugs work? Animal studies suggest rapamycin is as effective as long-term fasting. As elixirs of life go, long-term fasting is a surprising candidate, yet it seems to work. Experiments on species from nematode worms to rhesus monkeys shows that near starvation prolongs lifespan. And though no life-term experiment has been conducted to prove the same is true in Homo sapiens, short-term ones suggest similar physiological changes happen. Mysteriously, however, most people are loath to trade 3 square meals a day in the here and now for the promise of a longer retirement. So the search has been on for chemical alternatives to fasting. Two molecules in particular have attracted attention. Rapamycin, an immunosuppressant used to stop the rejection of transplanted kidneys, and metformin, an anti-diabetes drug. June 19th saw the publication of a paper summarizing the evidence of their effectiveness in animals compared with fasting. Both rapamycin and metformin have drawn the attention of the Live Forever Brigade because they inhibit what is known as the mTOR pathway. Indeed, mTOR stands for mechanic target of rapamycin. Overactivization of this in old age is associated with hallmarks of aging, such as inflammation. Conversely, fasting suppresses mTOR activity. That promotes autophagy, a phenomenon in which cells clear out their accumulated crud, which is reckoned lifespan enhancing. Moreover, both substances also have the advantages of having undergone safety trials as part of approval for their on-label uses and of being off-patent and therefore cheap. Being off-patent, however, cuts both ways. It means commercial sponsors for human clinical trials are hard to find since they cannot monopolize sales. As a result, the Targeting Aging with Metformin trial, a proposal sponsored by the American Federation for Aging Research, a charity, and approved by the Food and Drug Administration in 2015, remains in abeyance for lack of funds. Rapamycin, by contrast, has been tested in what is known as the PEARL trial. This began in July 2020, but this found no strong evidence that it worked. Animal tests have proved more definitive. The new paper published in Aging Cell by Richard Ivimi Cook of Glasgow University and his colleagues gathers all the vertebrae trial evidence that the authors could find. This amounts to 167 studies on 8 species, ranging from fish to monkeys. The answers seem clear-cut. To no one's surprise, calorie restriction works. So, to a pretty much equal extent, does rapamycin. But metformin does not. That is a blow to those, their number unknown but probably amounting to thousands, who have twisted their doctor's arms to get an off-label prescription of it for life extension. But it is a boost to those who have opted for rapamycin. These include Vinold Khosla, one of Silicon Valley's best-known venture capitalists, until recently Brian Johnson, another California techie, who has made a second career out of his quest for immortality. Mr. Johnson, however, dropped rapamycin in 2024 because of its side effects, abnormal lipid and glucose levels, elevated heart rate, and increased risk of skin infection. All of which is interesting, but for mere mortals who want a long and healthy life without the risk of rapamycin side effects, the advice remains the same. Eat wisely, drink moderately, exercise regularly, sleep well, and stub out that cigarette. From Bartleby, it's precisely midday, and it's my greatest pleasure to be chairing the last panel discussion of the morning. We're going to spend the next 30 minutes talking about the impact of something important on something else important. I'm your moderator, and I should have done more preparation. 1201. Joining me is a stellar lineup of people you've never heard of. Furthest away from me is Lee Smith, who is the Vice President for Sustainability, Communications, Technology, and Stationery at the IDBBB. Next to him is Alan Pheasant, a serial entrepreneur. Alan has plainly forgotten the first rule of panels, which is that the only time your socks will have the attention of hundreds of people. And finally, looming over us on the big screen like someone from the Galactic Empire is Anne Van Ark, head of investor relations at Silver Mullet. 1202. Anne L. Lee, which sounds so much worse than I say it out loud. Welcome. Could I start by asking you to give me your brief opening thoughts on this vital topic? Lee, I'll turn to you first. 1207. Lee, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we only have 23 minutes left for this session, and so far the only thing you have told us is what the IDBBB does. Alan, can you perhaps pick up on what Lee said and make it sound interesting? 1209. Apparently not. Emperor Palpatine, which is what is Silver Mullet doing to mitigate the impact of the one thing on the other thing. 1211. Thank you, Anne. Too late. I now remember the second rule of conference panels, which is never to ask people for opening remarks. We have less than 20 minutes left. So, a reminder to the audience that I will be coming to you for questions soon. You can either raise your hand or send them in via the event app if you can get it to work. 1212. Lee, I know this next question makes no sense at all, but it sounds clever. What do you think would count as a deep seek moment in this context? 1215. I'm sorry to interrupt again, Lee, but we've only got 15 minutes left now, and all I can really say with certainty is that you are employed by the IDBBB. Let's throw it out to the audience for questions. I see a hand up at the back there. The thick-set gentleman in glasses. Just wait for the microphone, please. Oh, I'm so sorry, madam. It's very dark out there. So, all I can see are your silhouettes. What was your question? 1220. That wasn't really a question, was it? More like a filibuster. Are you related to Lee by any chance? 1221. More questions, please. Don't be shy. I can see more hands going up. Let's go to the woman in the terrible sweater. Please wait for the microphone to get to you. Just don't expect it to get there quickly. The third rule of conference panels is that at least 10% of it will be spent watching someone carrying the microphone to the wrong person. Another 5% will be spent on the eventual recipients treating it like a Neanderthal being handed a toaster, tapping on it, blowing on it, looking at it in apparent wonder. 1222. Do go ahead, madam. Stop tapping it. What was your question? 1222. I have literally no idea what you just said, but let me rephrase it in a way that suits me. I think what you are saying is what we'd be saying if we were to be asked back for the same panel in 2030. I know what Lee would be saying, something interminable about the IDBBB. So let's turn this one over to Alan. 1226. Thank you, Alan. We have time for one more question. Can we go to the misshapen person right at the back with two hands up? Further back, further back. That's the one. What's that? It's a potted plant? Well then, let's try and round up everything we have learned. Anne, from your vantage point on the bridge of the Imperial Superstar Destroyer, what's the one thing people should take away from this session, apart from regrets? 1228. Alan, Lee, anything brief you want to add to the final minutes? 1230. I'm sorry to cut you short again. Lee, our time is up. And it will take us several minutes to get out of these ludicrously deep armchairs. Lunch is now being served. We'll be back here in the main hall in an hour. Please join me in thanking our amazing panelists for a very informative discussion. That's all the time we have for today. This has been Mary Kiefer with a reading of The Economist. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.